Hello, and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Bant, and along with me on this journey revisiting 80s movies is my co-host, Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
Vito, somewhere your values got screwy. Where the hell did you get it in your head that it was so terrible to be a thief?
How do you get through to someone who thinks like a gypsy?
Right. Stand-up thieves, gypsies. Not a hypocritical bone in their bodies.
That's right, listeners. We are discussing, with spoilers aplenty, the 1989 neo-noir crime movie Family Business, produced by Regency International Pictures and distributed by TriStar Pictures. It stars Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, and Matthew Broderick. Directed by Sidney Lumet, this movie is rated R with a running time of 1 hour and 50 minutes. The movie is based on the book of the same name written by Vincent Patrick, which was released in 1985. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the early 1990s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
It's the perfect crime. Put a key card in the lock, get in, get out, and split $1 million. No violence, no guesswork, no cops, no sweat. What could go wrong? What doesn't go wrong? Academy Award winners Sean Connery and Dustin Hoffman team with Matthew Broderick to play three generations of the same family, intent on family business. Burglary. Somehow, someway, they're determined to make crime pay. But the real payoff is seeing these three great stars in a laughs and larceny movie treat. Family business.
Family business. So that was What's on the Box. Jason, by the way, nice Sean Connery there at the beginning.
Thanks. I could have laid it on even a little more thick, but I'm okay with it.
I think people knew right away who you were doing there. So nice.
I appreciate that, Bill Bant. You're a McMullen.
Thank you. All right. Do you want to start off with our earliest memories of Family Business?
Let's get into some business. First, I wanted to say this much. This film was released on December 15th, 1989, just making the cut for our 80s podcast. How about that?
Yes.
Just under the wire. So yeah, let's get into some early memories. I have to admit, when I saw this film on our schedule, Bill Bant, I did not recognize it at first. And then you mentioned the cast and the plot synopsis, and vague memories started coming back to me. So I must stress the word vague because I barely have any real early memories of my external experiences watching this outside the fact that it was either a rental or cable watch, because 1989 was another big year for movies. So I was probably watching Batman, Roadhouse, The Abyss, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Black Rain, Dead Poets Society, Glory, Major League, License to Kill, Bill and Ted's, Tango and Cash. You get it. Big year, lots of movies. And I saw, I think, most of those in the theater actually that year. I was not going to the theater or running out to the theater to see Family Business. However, I do specifically remember wanting to see this film eventually, simply and obviously because of the cast, Broderick, Hoffman, and Connery. And of course, I was a fan of Broderick, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Hoffman, Rain Man, Connery, the Bond films, of course. Then, as the VHS synopsis says, it's a caper movie. Perfect. This should be great. This should be fun. I was looking forward to it when I was much younger. And outside of that, once I started the rewatch, the memory of the burglary scene, that came back to me. I was like, oh, yes. I remember this scene. I remember it being tough a little bit emotionally when I saw it first time, you know, and it started coming back to me. And then I seem to recall watching this movie, at least parts of it, a couple of times. And then lastly, I distinctly remember feeling that it was sort of flat. It wasn't what I expected overall. I don't recall thinking it was awful by any means, just that it was a bit, I don't know, slow, like a little, maybe a little plodding, a little slow and a bit unfulfilling by the time it was over. I just don't have much to say besides that, Bill Bant. So I was definitely looking forward to seeing this again to see if I might get something more out of it upon this revisit. What are your earliest memories, Bill Bant?
Yeah, so for me, this was certainly a rental, and I did watch it on the cable a bunch of times when it came on. And I remember the reason I wanted to see this movie is because who was in the movie? You know, we have Sean Connery, James Bond, Highlander, The Presidio, The Untouchables, Last Crusade, Matthew Broderick, War Games, Ferris Bueller, that we've done on our show. Max Dugan Returns, which was a big one for me. I remember my mom taking me to see that in the theater. And then it's kind of funny when you think about the three names, the one that I knew the least filmography wise, where I'd seen the least, was Dustin Hoffman. Because to me, it was basically Tootsie and Rain Man. And then maybe I'd seen parts of Kramer and Kramer as a kid, but I really hadn't seen much of his stuff until really college and beyond, when I really went back and watched his filmography. So I was really watching it more for Connery and Broderick. I know when the movie came out, people really made a big stink about the fact that Connery, Hoffman, and Broderick did not look like they should ever be together in a family. I just didn't care. And I know the film spends a lot of time trying to explain that out, so we would buy it. But I remember that being a big thing of contention. But then you have Connery, who came out in Last Crusade earlier in that year, and he was only 12 years older than Harrison Ford. So why is it okay there and not here? I don't know. But I do remember mostly was the burglary scene or robbery, however you want to call it. And then Broderick getting caught and being a little sad about that, kind of like what you thought about. Rest of the movie is a blur, to be honest. So I think, once again, I put this on the schedule because it has Sean Connery and Dustin Hoffman and Matthew Broderick. I was like, hey, we should cover this. I mean, they're three big actors, especially in the 80s. I do want to shout out to character actor in the movie, Bill Hutchinson, who played Darty, the guy who was running the bar, only because I was a big fan of his when I was little, because he was in this movie. It was 1979. I was like, oh, I wish we could have done this on our show. It's called Hot Stuff, and it starred Dom DeLuise, Susan Plachette, and Jerry Reed. And it's the first movie I ever remember as a kid, like literally rolling on the floor laughing. And I think the humor of that movie was of that for a 7 and 8 year old. And Bill McCutcheon is in this movie, and I think he has the funniest scene in it. That one's like the gut buster scene he had in that movie. So seeing him in this was like, oh my God, I have not seen this guy since Hot Stuff. And I'm sure if I went back and watched this movie again as an adult, it'd be like, this movie sucks, because it's all like toilet humor kind of stuff. And the whole premise of the movie is DeLuise and Plachette and Reed play cops. They deal in stolen goods, and they throw this party for all these people they've bought stolen goods for. And then this big fight breaks out, and Bill, he just has this hilarious moment to me at the time as a 7 year old, which I thought was hysterically funny. So it was good to see him in this, because I really hadn't seen him in much since then. Yeah. So that's my earliest memories. I wanted to see it because of the actors.
Heck yeah, man. 100%. I think it's pretty straightforward. And Bill McCutcheon, although he has a small role in this, is great, I think. It's not like he has a ton to do, but yeah, he plays Danny Doheny, the owner of Doheny's, the bar in New York City there. He has a great voice. I do like his voice. It's very old timey.
Yes.
So I enjoyed him in this, again, albeit a brief appearance. So yeah, you ready to get into some IT initial thoughts?
Yeah, let's do it. What do you got?
We're going to start with our director. His name is Sidney Lumet. Ever heard of him? Well, he is a legend in the biz. Bill Bant, he was born in your hometown, Philly. But he actually grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He had a reputation for making realistic and gritty New York dramas, which focused on the working class, tackled social injustices, and often questioned authority. He was nominated 5 times for Academy Awards. 4 for Best Director for 12 Angry Men, Dog Day Afternoon Network, and The Verdict. And 1 for Best Adapted Screenplay for Prince of the City. He received the Academy Honorary Award in 2004. And if that doesn't jog your memory, well, I'm just going to go over the quick snapshot of his work. Sidney goes all the way back to the early 50s when he started directing several episodic TV series. Then in 57, he directs 12 Angry Men. Just go watch it. It's an all-timer. He goes back to directing in television for a few years, and then in the 60s, he's back to directing features, notably Long Day's Journey Into Night, then Failsafe. But I'll jump ahead to the 70s when he gives us Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, and then on to the 80s, he gives us Prince of the City, Death Trap, The Verdict, Running on Empty, and jumping all the way ahead to the aughts, he directs. I just put this in here because I find it funny. He directed Find Me Guilty with Vin Diesel in 2006. And his final film was Before the Devil Knows You're Dead in 07 with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke, and Albert Finney. I know that is a critically acclaimed film, and I still have never seen it. I need to go back and watch that movie for Sidney Lumet, and I'm a big Philip Seymour Hoffman fan. Needless to say, Sidney Lumet has close to around, you could say, 10 all-time classics, and just had that hell of a run in the 70s and those bangers in the 80s. He is respected as one of the all-time great directors. He unfortunately did pass away in 2011 at age 86. And now, okay, getting right into my initial thoughts. Meh, blah. That's kind of my general review of this movie. It's fine. After this revisit, I think I felt as I did the first time I saw it. It was fine. I was walking around my apartment after watching it again recently here in the last couple of days, and I was talking out loud to myself, Bill Bant, and I just like, I don't know what to make of this. It's yes, of course. It's a father-son movie. It's about fathers and sons. We have our father, Vito McMullen, played by Dustin Hoffman, who was at one time a criminal, but went straight and is now well off in the meat processing business and wants a better life for his son. And we have the son, in this case, the young adult, 22 years old, almost going on, or almost 23 year old Adam, played by Matthew Broderick. And he wants to have his own life and make his own choices. And he chooses to do this caper in this movie. And he pitches it to the eldest of the McMullens, the grandfather, the ex-criminal, the lifelong criminal, Jesse, played by Sean Connery. Jesse's really indulging in this time he has with his grandson, Adam, and encouraging him to take ownership as an adult. And even though that may mean making choices which lead him down this path of crime. So yeah, there's themes here about family, obviously, embracing your lineage, who you really are, letting go of the past, a resentment toward a parent, in this case, a father, for the choices they made in raising you. That's all great. It's all here. The question was for me, Bill Bant, is why don't I feel anything while I'm watching this movie? The performances are good. The performances are really good. This is our first, if I'm not mistaken, Dustin Hoffman movie and our first Sean Connery movie. It's a great choice to put it on the schedule, Bill. I agree with you. So that's cool. Although I have to say, it does feel like Sean Connery is being himself a lot in this, just taking advantage of being bullish and chewing the scenery up all the time, which is fine. It's fine. We love him. I love him. And as much as I like Broderick, he's fine in this. The problem is I had an issue with his character. I just don't understand his motivations, really. So his character's not great. It's not totally defined, but it's not terrible. I'll start with the trailer. Ladies and gents, if you haven't seen this in a while, just watch the trailer and see this is kind of what I'm talking about. It's misleading. It makes it seem as though this is a family heist comedy. But as Wikipedia describes it, it is a neo-noir crime film. And so what is it? Is it a comedy? Is it a family drama? I didn't think it was very funny. And if anything, it's pretty dramatic and dour. Look, we get a sense of who characters are. We get a feel for the New York City scene. The landscape is great. Sidney Lumet is a master at that. We even get some great side characters within it. Like we mentioned, Danny Doheny and Doheny's bar. We get Margie, who's Jesse's girl, and she works at Doheny's bar. We get this character, Phil, who keeps popping in and out, selling stolen goods that, quote unquote, fell off a truck. So the dialogue's written pretty well. I appreciate the realistic and conversational style. The words move pretty fast in this. And I like the language. This movie, you know, I was just talking about the landscape. It feels lived in. Great. But I'm still not feeling invested in the story for some reason. It was frustrating. Why? And I think it's because of lack of character motivation, as I mentioned with Broderick's character, and the caper itself and the overall presentation is flat for me. The film does fine in establishing the framework and the character outlines. As I mentioned, we have our main obstacle, the caper, and whether or not Vito, Dustin Hoffman, the dad in between the grandfather and the grandson, will he go in on this caper with them, and will they or won't they pull off the caper itself? But what makes for a good caper? For me, it's the planning. How are they going to do it? I want to see the details, the setting of the building, the blueprints, the potential alarms, traps, risks, tools to pull it off. I love the tools. Like we talked about this when we covered Thief on our podcast. And then the action of the actual job. That's the juice, right? Speaking of great movie Heat, not to mention the object of theft itself, what they're stealing, and maybe its delicacy or its worth. And that's kind of weird and vague in this. Anyway, regardless, I understand maybe this movie is more about the relationships, less about the caper. but I just don't know why Adam needs to do this job. What's the impetus behind it? Is it just in his genes? Is it for the thrill of it? Is it because he wants this exciting lifestyle like his grandfather leads? And speaking of the grandfather, he's in it. Jesse, Sean Connery, he's in it at the drop of a hat and generally jovial and enthusiastic. And Vito is really the only one dealing with an internal struggle between giving in to his old ways of crime or protecting his son, Adam, and doing the right thing. And we just don't get a lot of the why these characters are who they are until some of the dialogue, like sound bites towards the end, and it feels like a little too much too late. So my question, Bill Band, is where's the danger, the fun, the consequences? And I know you may touch upon that. A lot of it feels like redundant dialogue over top of everything with Vito and his resentments towards Jesse and Jesse being the cool old guy telling stories and Adam sort of being disrespectful and spoiled, but we're not uncovering the real meat of it. Okay, I'm becoming redundant myself. What stood out for me was actually the women of the movie Family Business. I like Rosanna DeSoto as Elaine McMullen, who plays Vito's wife, Adam's mother. Janet Carroll is great as Margie, who she works at Doheny's Bar. She's a waitress there. She's also Jesse's girl. And Deborah Rush as Michelle Dempsey, Adam's lawyer. She's a hard ass. She's really strong in an extended scene that she has. These characters, although in supporting roles, had some inner strength, although they, because for me, it's like they choose to stay in these unhealthy relationships. Speaking of Elaine, Vito's wife, and Margie, who's Jesse's girl, but they're like these knockaround girls, as is mentioned in the film. And I'm more interested in knowing why they stick around in these relationships. They were a little more interesting to me. So overall, the movie's okay. It has some fine performances, but I wasn't really rooting for everyone or anyone in it. Ends with this whimper on a dour note, as I mentioned, and I don't need to hear the entire Danny Boy song again. That's it. That's my overall take. As watching this as an adult, what are your initial thoughts, Bill Bant?
There's a lot that you mentioned that I agree with. I think overall with this movie, it's just a weak story with a really strong performance by Sean Connery. Unfortunately, I never read the book, so maybe there's just a lot missing from the story that didn't make it on the screen. I think Dustin Hoffman is kind of stuck, just like he is in the film between Jesse and Adam. He has some great scenes with Connery, while his relationship with Adam is very uneven. And like you, I don't understand Adam's motivation at all for doing this. He's like resentful for his dad for giving him good things. And that doesn't make any sense to me. And like you said, they don't explain why Adam wants to do this. They explain more into how Hoffman and Connery and Broderick are related than why Adam wants to do this crime. And then we meet a random character, Bill Hutchinson, who's really cool. And then all of a sudden he dies and we have a funeral in the middle of the movie. And you're like, what? What is that all about? I don't know. There's a randomness to it that I just didn't get.
Agreed.
Even Jesse going to jail, that still made no sense to me at the end. You know, they perform the crime. Spoiler alert, Adam gets caught. They want Adam to rat out who was he was partners with, and then the return the stolen goods. And Adam doesn't want to do that, which, again, makes no sense to me. This kid has no idea what it's like being in jail, and he's willing to do this for his grandfather and dad. And, of course, his dad's stuck in the middle because he thinks they should turn themselves in. And Jesse doesn't think that they should, and he'd prefer Adam to rot, I guess. I don't know. So none of that makes sense to me. And then we find out that the whole purpose of the crime was to give this lab time to produce results that they thought they were going to produce at an earlier point. We'll get into the story a little bit later. But they figure this out, and then Jesse has the lab by the balls, and he takes a bribe and then ends up going to jail. They haven't dropped the charges. And then you all go away scot-free. That I couldn't figure out why it ended up that way. The biggest sticking point is Broderick's character. Because if Vito wasn't so successful and could give Adam everything he wanted, and I get Adam doesn't want the silver spoon, but wants to earn stuff on his own. But why crime? Why crime? And knowing that both his father and Jesse went to jail, why would you want to do the same thing? Why do you want to end up in prison and be someone's bitch? You are no way built to be in prison. No way. And he's so defiant about it. I'm like, no, if your dad's going to turn his stuff in, you let him do that because you're not going to last 6 months. So I think you're too busy questioning Adam's motivation throughout the film that kind of ruins the film itself. But I thought Sean Connery was great in it. He was a lot of fun. He was eating up the scenery. And like you said, it almost seems like he is just playing himself. And nice shout out to the women characters. They do have some key moments in the movie that really helps move the story along, as weak as it is. Yeah, I think it was the same thing that we went with. It was interesting, but there's nothing great about it. It's not terrible. It is cool just to see all three of those actors sharing the screen together. That's what I liked. But yeah, story-wise, not that great. That's my initial thoughts.
Totally agree. And yeah, Connery is really fun to watch just doing his thing. So if you are a Sean Connery fan, this film is for you. I really appreciate Dustin Hoffman. I think he's a master. He's really emotionally torn in this. And I appreciate the scenes he has with both Adam and Connery. I mean, just trying to figure out what the right thing is to do. So yeah, overall in agreement and confounded as well as to the final courtroom sequence and sentencing and how that unfolds, because it doesn't really make any sense. So we're left with the question why when it comes to Broderick and the consequences of the caper. So, but we can start getting into our favorite scenes and moments if you're ready.
Yeah, let's do that. Favorite scenes or moments. So for me, for my first favorite scene, it's a scene between Vito and Adam. Kind of opens up at a Passover. So we find out that, just to give you the background of how this family works. So Connery married an Italian woman, had a kid, and that was Vito. Vito married a Jewish woman, and they had Broderick. So they're at a Passover, and they're at this kind of rundown part of the neighborhood. And we also find out during this dinner that Adam was in college. I think it was MIT
MIT, right? Yep.
on scholarship. And he only had 6 months to go to get, I think it was his master's. And
Somebody says 6 months and they're like, no, it was 3 months. He's actually, yeah, like he was 3 months away. I'm just saying that because they actually make it a point to say that.
so he kind of dropped out going into his last semester, and usually Passover, I think it's usually around Easter. So you figure this is March. It's like 3 months since he's dropped out of college, and he has not spoken to his dad at all. So this is the first time his dad has seen, Vito has seen Adam since he dropped out. And of course, Dustin Hoffman has questions on why this happened. And during the Passover itself, there's a phone call. For some reason, Adam goes to answer it, and it's Jesse, who's his grandfather. And they have a quick talk on the phone. And at the end of the dinner, they're outside. And of course, Vito asks right away, oh, what was your conversation with Jesse about? Find out that Jesse was in a bar fight and it was with a cop. And first he says, wax him. And I was like, holy crap, he killed the cop. But just wax him in this sense means he just kicked the crap out of him. And now he's in jail for it. So he needs Adam to come help get him out of jail. So, in the course of the conversation, we see that Adam really admires Jesse, and Vito basically asks Adam to pump the brakes a little bit. Vito wants Adam to stay away from Jesse. Adam comes back with, oh, Jesse's not going to hurt me. And Vito says, no, he's not, but it'll happen anyway. So, you kind of get a sense of Vito and Jesse are really estranged, and it's just been a bad relationship. So then Adam asks Vito for some bail money, and Vito says he's not going to give it to him because last time he's paid for bail, he never got the money back. So Adam turns around and asks for a loan, and he asks him a loan, $800. And lucky for Vito, Vito's got the money there. So you know Vito's pretty loaded. Vito obliges, and then we get into Vito telling Adam a story about when he was seven, and it was right after his mom passed. And it was around Christmas time, and they were looking for a tree, and they stop at a gas station because there was a tree on the roof of the station, and Vito's being lookout while Jesse goes onto the top of the gas station to steal a tree because it had the lights and all the trimmings. And Adam's kind of laughing at it, and Vito's like, no, you shouldn't be laughing at it. That's how my whole life was. I was playing lookout for my dad. And, here I am being a 7, 8-year-old. And my dad's bringing me into a life of crime, which is not good. But Adam doesn't feel that way. He thinks Jesse's really cool. He thinks he's really special. Vito kind of sees this, but he just keeps telling him, Don't follow him. You don't need to go that path. I gave you a better life. At that point, Vito kind of says, thanks, Adam, for saying something to his mom's grandparents about moving out. That way, maybe they'll actually do it instead of try to stay in the neighborhood. And Adam replies, when someone loves you, you have a hell of a weapon in the relationship. And Vito replies that it's both ways, that it can go both ways, meaning Jesse might do something to you. And then they ended up parting ways. So I thought it was a good interchange between Hoffman and Broderick. I think it's really the only one that I liked between the two of them, because I just always thought from that point on, Adam just seemed so over the top about wanting to commit this crime and then always blaming his dad for leaving crime to take care of him and giving him the silver spoon, which didn't make any sense to me. So I think this is the one time the two of them actually have a moment together that works. So that's why I like that opening scene.
It's a nice way to set up the scenario to come and the dynamic between the grandfather, father, and grandson slash son. Yeah, it's I agree. You know, I thought about putting this in my favorite scenes as well. And it's just really a father trying to protect his son here and forewarning him of the dangers of Jesse McMullen, this grandfather who's just led this life of crime, and that so much so that he involved his own son, Vito, in it when he was young. And it's, it's heartfelt. You see the naivete coming from Broderick as if he's just and you see the genuine fondness he has for his grandfather, almost as if he looks up to his grandfather for having led this romantic, exciting, adventurous lifestyle of crime, as if that's somehow attractive and alluring. But Vito's warning him of the realities of it, and it's just something you don't want to be a part of. So it's good character establishment. As you know, I love a good intro scene that establishes the characters very well, and it sets it up for things to come. We just know that, oh, now we can't wait to see who Jesse is and how he operates and the character that he is, the personality that he has, the traits that he actually has. And is he really whom Vito is describing? Is he all that bad? Good call, man. Good call.
All right. What do you got for a scene or a moment?
So it's not too shortly after the scene you just laid out for us. And this is what I'm calling Adam and Jesse present Vito with the plan at Doheny's bar. So we know that Vito is disappointed that Adam dropped out of school, but he still loves him and wants the best for him. And we've established this fondness that Adam has for his grandfather. And after Adam bails his grandfather out of jail, which is immediately following the scene Bill Bant just described, they go out on the town and spend the night hanging out, Adam and Jesse, grandson and grandfather. And it's fun. We meet some other characters. They have dinner. They go to Doheny's, I believe, and have a drink and then go for breakfast. So they're up early in the morning. And this is when Adam, Matthew Broderick, presents Jesse, Sean Connery, with this opportunity. And it's a scam. And he only mentions that he had been approached by his ex-professor, a Chinese-American, and that it's supposed to be an easy job and the payout is $1 million. And of course, Jesse, who was a little skeptical at first, then when he hears the dollar amount, is like, oh, this is more than attractive. Let's see if we can pull this off. But the thing is, they're going to need a third person to pull off this caper. So they're going to ask Vito. And they know, as we know, that Vito will be a little resistant because of his own resentment toward Jesse and his life of crime and raising him as a criminal and the resistance toward this sort of lifestyle, which he was exposed to while growing up. So now we are at Doheny's bar and Jesse and Adam are sharing a drink at a table in the back. And they're going to have this sit down with Vito to try to convince him to be in on this caper. And I love that we're just going to keep saying caper probably throughout this. And we describe it as a robbery, burglary, or caper. I want to say heist, but it's almost like heist light. It's a caper. It's a caper. Vito shows up at Doheny's. And we get this, Bill McCutcheon comes around, as we mentioned, he plays Danny Doheny, the owner. He comes around the bar and tells an old story about how Jesse used to take Vito into the bar as a baby in a stroller and used Vito's stroller to sneak in slips because he was running numbers out of the bar. And then we learned that Doheny himself was a cop before he was a bar owner, and he got busted himself for running a scam. And anyway, he now owns the bar. But the point is, Vito hasn't seen his father, the grandfather role, Jesse, in a long time. And he's always skeptical of Jesse. And so we see as the audience here and know as the audience that this is going to be tough convincing Vito to join in on this caper. So as Vito sits down, he can see that Adam and Jesse have become quite chummy overnight. It's interesting because Adam actually hadn't seen his grandfather in some time. It's like an indeterminate amount of time, but it had been a long time. But over this one night, they get reacquainted. And now at this bar scene, they're like two old buddies enjoying a drink. Vito walks in and he doesn't like what he sees. And he doesn't want Jesse. And he's immediately accusatory of Jesse trying to persuade Adam into any of his schemes. And it's revealed that Vito himself actually did time back in the day for a caper gone wrong, if you will. And he did 27 months in the shitter, as Jesse says. And we do meet another side character here. We meet Margie, who walks in and she works at the bar. And there's some fast dialogue and quips and jabs back and forth between Jesse and Vito about how crime doesn't pay and you spend your life hiding from that crime and that. What's going on here? Because he's just befuddled. Like, he's confounded that Adam even is considering doing any kind of caper. And he's like, what is this? This type of life run in the genes? And Jesse shoots that theory down. Vito can't believe that this job is actually Adam's idea. And he thinks he's just throwing his whole life away for money. And then Adam says bitingly, if it's money I wanted, I go into the wholesale meat business. And this hurts Vito. And he's like, that's not fair. You know, I hate the fucking meat business. I broke my ass to give you what he never gave me, meaning Jesse. And Adam responds with, I never asked you for anything. But Vito cuts him off right away. He's like, you never had to. You never had to ask for anything, saying that he provided him with everything he could ever need. And then Adam replies with, Pop, this doesn't have anything to do with money. You never understood me and you still don't. And we as an audience are still trying to understand, but the conversation takes a real turn when Vito lays down an ultimatum and tells Adam, you're not doing this. And Adam says, I'm doing it and there's nothing you can do about it. Vito responds with, oh, really? There's nothing I can do? There's nothing I can do? And he reaches across the table and slaps Adam across the face. Adam gets up and walks out. And of course, Jesse is looking on the entire time. It's an awkward scene. And Jesse is a little disapproving of Vito slapping at him. And he's like, here, leave a 20 on the bar. I don't want a Doheny telling anyone I raised a cheapskate. So we really see this deep rift between Vito and Jesse and how desperately Vito wants to keep Adam out of this life. So much so that he ends up slapping Adam at the end. Just he's very emotional about it. And you see a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, a lot of regret, a lot of bitterness coming from Vito. Obviously, he doesn't really even like his own life working in this meat business, but he feels like a bit of a martyr because he gave up his life so that Adam could have a better one. He sacrificed everything for Adam, whereas Jesse just sees the world differently. He is old school. He disapproves of Vito's choices to go straight. And literally, this goes back to the opening quote, what's so wrong living your life as a thief? And that's literally how he thinks that that's okay. So we really get this, polarity here, this opposite nature between Jesse and Vito, but Vito really is of the same cloth, cut from the same cloth, but he's denying it. And Adam really is for some reason wanting to embrace this lifestyle. So it's an interesting dynamic to watch. Again, I appreciate this lived-in feel of being in the back of this bar and all the characters are familiar locals and they have stories and things like that. And we get a real sense of the history between these characters and this really deep-seated rift between Jesse and Vito. So again, just more good character establishment. And we're then left thinking, oh my gosh, how is Vito ever going to want to be part of this caper? And then the scenes unfold after this and we see how that comes to be. But I thought this scene there was pretty well written and the dialogue's just flying back and forth and the jabs. So I liked it.
Yeah, this is definitely the best scene between the three of them. Probably should have been in my favorite scenes or moments, to be honest. This setup is pretty cool because Adam and Jesse have talked about this caper and they need a third person. They want to try to talk Vito into it. And Jesse tells Adam, let me do the talking. I know how to get to Vito. And it might be by doing it this way, by kind of getting under his skin. And especially being a father trying to provide for your kids, I would probably say 80%, probably even more than that, of parents who are trying to provide for their kids are in a job or in a work situation that they hate or despise or realize this is what I need to do in order to make sure my kids have a roof, they have food on the table, et cetera, et cetera. And as a kid, yes, you do not get that. Adam is older enough to understand. So when he takes that zinger about the meat packing, oh, I think I would have slapped him too, to be honest.
It's pretty harsh.
Yeah. He wanted his dad to be a criminal the whole time, maybe not see him through half his childhood because he's in prison. I still don't, just don't understand Adam's thinking in this.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no acceptance in this. It's like Jesse doesn't accept the fact that Vito wanted to go straight. Adam doesn't accept that Vito did what he can to provide him a good life. And maybe, granted, you know, Vito should accept the fact that his son wants to be a criminal. I mean, but that's not what you raise your kids to do. That's why he made all those sacrifices, to give his kid a better life and to make better choices, that he doesn't have to make those type of choices. You know, a lot of people out there who commit crime, they do it because they have to do it. Yes, there probably is some people out there that do it for shits and giggles, but not everyone. So Adam is certainly in the minority when it comes to that. And I get it too. He didn't want everything laid out for him moving forward. Yes, and you can make changes, but you have all the tools to make those changes. It's not like you have to do this. You didn't have to do this. You could have done something else. So it does make it a little bit confusing. But watching the three of them together, sitting around that table, kind of wish, where is this in the rest of the movie? It's a good scene. I do enjoy it.
Good call on the dynamic with the three of them in this. It is fun to watch the back and forth, and you just want to be a fly on the wall or on that location just to be a part of that, because it's three heavy hitters in this movie together. And I'm glad you presented the parent perspective, and because you're a parent yourself, and you know in this how Vito just wants to protect his son. That's it. He genuinely has good cause. He has experience in this. He knows what Jesse can be like, and how seductive Jesse can be and manipulative, even if not intentional. And boy, Broderick, Adam, his character really goes for the jugular, and it comes a little out of nowhere. And that's why you're like, you don't want to see Vito actually beat on his son, but you understand where that brief moment of rage comes from, because Adam's quite ungrateful in that moment and really attacks him personally. Right where it hurts. An effective scene.
Yeah.
If we're going chronologically here, Bill, am I up next with another scene?
I think I'm next.
You are. Okay. Go for it.
So I like this moment because we do get to see the real Vito. So what happens is, after, of course, the slap and Vito walks out, we have Jesse show up at the meatpacking plant that Vito, this manager, runs. Not really sure what, but he's high. He's definitely high up at this location. And he tells Vito, okay, if you're not going to help us with this caper, I found someone else. And Vito asks who it is. And Jesse tells him who this third person they're bringing in. And Vito's like, no way, that guy's a fuck up. You can't have him help you on this caper, because then he's more worried that his son will get caught. So he's really pissed. But he didn't say he's going to join. He's just pissed. And then Jesse walks off. At that moment, one of the other workers at the meatpacking plant come to Vito and say, hey, one of the employees, Torres, we think he's scamming from the meats. And one of the deliveries was shorted again. And it's always this one character that does it. So Vito's already on edge now, hearing about what his dad and son are going to do and who they're going to bring in. We see him back into the office and he's fuming. And the secretary's in there and she doesn't know, of course, about this possible crime, and just sees that Vito's really angry. And she kind of makes a joke that he's having a midlife crisis. And Vito asks her what Torres' salary is supposed to be. And he gets the money out and he takes out the money that he owes the meatpacking plant from stealing. And then we have Torres come in, who's played by Luis Guzman. And he's like, yeah, you wanted to see me, boss? He's like, yeah, I know what you've been doing. You've been skimming meat from the deliveries. You're out of here. Here's your money. Get out. I don't want to see you again. And then Torres comes back. Is like, well, you know, Torres is throwing excuses out there. And Vito's a little bit pissed. And he goes, hey, you know, when your daughter was sick and you needed help, you know, who helped you out? And Torres at first is like, okay, you're kind of right. But I wouldn't still be in this situation if you weren't paying us so low. And Torres comes back basically where he threatens Vito and his family. And Vito's like, really? And he leans into Torres and goes, what did you say? And before Torres can say anything, he headbutts him, breaking his nose.
Yeah.
Runs around the desk and just starts kicking the shit out of him. It's like, get the hell out of my office. Get the hell out of my office. So you really know, like, yeah, he would have really been a badass criminal. If he's acting like that 20 years later, imagine what he would have been now if he followed a life of crime. And it was kind of good to see that he still has a little bit in there. Maybe he is going to turn around and help them out. And he does have the tools to do it. It's just, you can't take the thief or the criminal out of him. It's still in there. It's buried, but unfortunately, because of Torres, it's bringing it a little bit to the surface. So I did like that scene. I thought it was kind of fun. And just seeing a little bit of Luis Guzman, shout out to him.
Great call. Always a pleasure to see Luis Guzman. He's awesome. And yeah, this was a bit of a surprise. I didn't remember this scene. And then as it unfolded, it was a shock when Vito just headbutts him because there's blood splatters everywhere and it's violent and it's a little shocking. And you're right, Bill Bant. It's a total character reveal here, or a character trait revealed, that he is his father's son. He was raised in a certain environment and within a certain lifestyle. And that is who he is. And he is a wolf in sheep's clothing almost. He is not afraid of violence. And he has a dark side. And we see it here. Like, oh, okay, that's who he really is. And I think at this point, too, things have boiled over a little bit for him. He's probably got a lot of emotional turmoil as a result of this choice that Adam's made to engage in a caper and plan this caper. And should he or should he not be a part of it? And the scene previous to this, we know that if Vito's not going to do it, Jesse is going to bring in some other low-level third wheel to help out, which isn't good. And now he's in a real bind. He's in a real spot. Because should he go on this caper with them to protect his son, to look after him then? It's funny because Jesse's actually subtly manipulated him at this point to be the third guy on this burglary. And no doubt it boils over in this scene. And
oh yeah,
Torres unfortunately gets the brunt of it. It's
big time.
Gets his ass kicked.
Doesn't even get to pick up his money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he just leaves. Tough stuff. Well, I'm going to get into a couple quick moments before going into my next scene. It's just some nice acting moments. We know Bill Bant really appreciates, as I do, Sean Connery's performance in this. I'm going to call out a couple of moments that Dustin Hoffman here has as Vito. At Danny Doheny's funeral, this is when Adam and Jesse actually lay out the details of this caper for Vito in a final attempt to persuade Vito to join them. They lay out the details that, yes, Adam's ex-professor, this Chinese-American, worked for a biology lab, and they had made the scientific discovery. And this is where it gets a little vague for me, but basically, they made a discovery, this replacement for fertilizer, basically to produce agriculture. It's an agricultural product. It's what they call these plasmids that will be able to produce wheat and other agricultural products without the use of fertilizer. It's a brilliant discovery of some kind. Basically, what happened to this Chinese-American professor of Adams was that he ended up getting fired from this company, but he himself had some venture capital and was about to start his own company, but couldn't continue this research without those plasmids, without this scientific discovery. Not only does he need those plasmids, but he needs his journal or these logbooks that have the information that relates to all of this. So this ex-professor of Adams wants Adam and his crew to steal the plasmids and the logbooks. And if they do that, then they get $1 million. That's their reward. That's their payout. And this is what they present to Vito. And in this moment, Vito has this realization like, oh, so this is just a fancy burglary. Like they're just going to rob a biology lab. Okay, no problem. And then he immediately looks at Adam and goes, the look on your face when you were talking about yeasts fixing nitrogen. Again, just being the dad going, I could see you light up when you were talking about science and you could just go down another path. But immediately Adam responds with, you're either in or out, Pop. No lectures. And Vito goes, I'm in. There's some great moments, really quick moments where Dustin Hoffman as Vito shifts and in his tactics in this scene and his responses, and then he agrees to do the job. After that, we know that, and we're skipping over a little bit or skimming over the caper sequence, the actual job, but they do get the plasmids in these test tubes that they place in a little Playmate igloo cooler, which is nice. And they manage to get the logbooks, what they had forgotten originally during this whole caper sequence. It gets bungled a little bit and they get out with the plasmids, but Adam has to go back inside for the journal, the logbooks, comes out, sets off the alarm and gets busted and caught by the cops. But Jesse and Vito get away with the plasmids in the logbook. So they have to leave Adam behind. And Adam now is going to jail for the time being. So this is what sets off a lot of the drama. And Vito and Jesse have a meeting with the lawyer who hopefully will be representing Adam, who is very expensive. And I mentioned her earlier. She's great. Deborah Rush. She plays the character Michelle Dempsey. She's going to be Adam's lawyer. And she's just really laying it out matter-of-factly for them. And they realize, well, the only way to get Adam a reduced sentence is if they turn themselves in. And they have to present the plasmids and the logbooks as well. So after this meeting, well, Vito and Jesse are going to have a little come to Jesus talk themselves, a little one-on-one. And there's some great physicality here. I actually really, really appreciated the physicality between Jesse and Vito in this movie, between Sean Connery and Dustin Hoffman. They're great together. The chemistry is great. You believe it, even though they don't look anything alike and the age difference is weird. Whatever you want to say, the acting is top-notch. And Vito loses it because he thinks his son is about to go to jail for a very, very long time. And he knows they have to turn themselves in. Jesse has a very different reaction. He's playing it calm and cool. And there's a moment where Vito screams at him and smacks Jesse in the forehead saying, you're not listening to me. You're not listening to me. And Jesse grabs him and calms him down and says, we're going to figure this out. We'll do it. We'll do whatever it takes. And we'll get to go back and talk to the lawyer. And again, in this moment, Jesse's actually being manipulative of Vito. And it's like, oh man, this guy, he really doesn't get it. So those are two moments I wanted to call out when Vito says he's going to be in on the caper. And then after the caper goes wrong and Adams got busted, Vito just lets Jesse have it. And that's another great acting moment. So this all leads up to the fact that although Jesse, like I said, he's being manipulative of Vito throughout this, and he makes Vito think that, yeah, they'll turn themselves in and the evidence and get Adam a much reduced sentence. But it she seems as though Jesse is not good for his word, and he's going to take off. He literally takes Vito's car and disappears. And now Vito is livid, and he runs back to Jesse's apartment. Jesse's apartment happens to be right above Doheny's bar, and Jesse's not home. Vito then, before he leaves, realizes, oh, maybe Jesse's hiding out with Margie, Jesse's girl, who also lives above Doheny's bar. So he goes to Margie's apartment and starts knocking on the door saying, Jesse, are you in there? Are you in there? And he's looking for Jesse. He's looking for the plasmids, and he's furious, and he just bursts into the apartment, knocking the door open just as Margie was about to open it for him. So the door hits Margie in the head. And does she call the cops or anything? Of course not. She's a knock-around girl. She understands how this works. Vito barges in. He is sort of apologetic, goes straight for the fridge and the freezer and gets some ice for her head and says, I didn't mean to do that. And she's like, well, you could have let me, I forgot what she said. I could have just let you in or told me you were coming in or something like that. Either way, she seems really understanding, and he's asking if Jesse's there. Where is he? She doesn't know. And he starts looking around her apartment for the plasmids, which are in these test tubes. And it's great because he's thinking as if how a thief would think or how his father Jesse would think. He goes back to the fridge And he starts taking things out like a jar of mayo or mustard or relish, or like these Tupperware containers. And he starts swirling around in them, thinking maybe this is where Jesse hid the test tubes. He's going through all of Margie's shit in her apartment right while she's sitting there because he's losing his mind, thinking his son is about to go to jail. He's totally frantic. And then Margie's just like, it keeps defending Jesse. Like, he's not here. I don't know where he is. I don't have what you're looking for. What happened? And Vito comes clean about the fact that Adam, and this is a tender moment because Vito's about to break down. And he says, my son might spend 15 years behind bars. He can barely get it out. And he says, 15 years in a cage. And Margie's like, oh, how the hell could you take Adam along on this caper? And he says, I wanted to protect him. And in a great moment, Margie responds with, bullshit, you enjoyed every minute of it. All of you guys do. And the look on Vito's face there is great, as if he realizes, you're right. This is who I am. I wanted to do this caper. And she says, why don't you turn yourselves in? And he says, without the goods, meaning the plasmids in the journal or logbooks, it's useless. And Margie just goes right over to the utility closet and pulls out the little Playmate igloo cooler that has the plasmids. She had the plasmids all along, and she turns them over to Vito. Vito now feels terrible because he hit her in the head with the door, and he just says, why don't you tell Jesse that, you know, I smacked you around, okay? And she says, I'll tell him to go fucking cut his wrists. Get that kid out of jail, Vito. I can take care of myself. So strong performance here by Janet Carroll as Margie, and she's now pissed at Jesse because he just bailed on the whole situation, and she now tells Vito to go protect his son in any way he can, and you just see this desperation from Vito. I just enjoyed the dynamic of the scene. You realize, oh man, this woman, she's been dating Jesse. She's a little bit older. She's quite wise, and she just knows how this world works, but she was going to protect Jesse until the end. Until she found out exactly what was happening and that Jesse may have actually left town and left the rest of them, hung them out to dry, and then turns over the plasmids. There's some good drama here, good writing, good acting. I love the fact when Vito goes to that fridge and starts looking through all the containers in the fridge as if Jesse may have hid the test tubes in there. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I did like that scene also, and the fact that Elaine, once she hears what is happening, once she gets the full story and realizes, bad enough, you're a criminal, your dad was a criminal, don't bring your son into this too, that she turns around and gives the plasmids to Vito right away. So I thought that was a good moment. Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's kind of weird. There's all these like great acting scenes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throughout the movie, but it just doesn't all fall into place like you kind of want it to. And that's what kind of makes it disappointing. And here's just another example of it. Hoffman and Janet Carroll are just great together in that scene.
Yeah.
Why is this not working throughout the film?
It's interesting you mentioned that. I'll just say this really briefly is when we go back and do notes, or at least when I do, I'll watch particular scenes. And when you take them out of context, you're just like, oh my God, this would be great for an acting class.
Exactly.
This would be great for a scene study class. Oh, this is heavy. The writing's excellent. Performances are wonderful. Man, this is really good. This is really good. But when you put it all together, it doesn't flow for whatever reason. It doesn't have impact. Hard to make good movies.
Yeah. Perfect example right there. Yeah. So for me, for my last favorite scene moment, it is a moment. Moving forward with the story, yes, Vito does take the plasmids in and the logbook in, turns himself in, turns his father in. And now we cut to the courtroom scene and they're getting sentenced. And luckily, Vito and Adam are on probation, but the judge ends up throwing the book at Jesse. And Jesse's got to do really about 10 years, which is a life sentence at that point. So we see that Jesse goes to jail and he gets really sick. And he only wants Adam to come visit him. He doesn't want to deal with Vito at all. And Adam's not talking to Vito either because of him turning himself in and his grandfather. But it gets to the point where Adam sees that Jesse is dying. He's not going to make it. So he does reach out to Vito and says, hey, you need to go visit Jesse. He's really sick. I don't know how much longer he's going to live. And it's been a couple of months at this point. And Vito decides, okay, he is going to meet his dad. It's bad enough. Him and his dad aren't talking. Him and his son aren't talking. Maybe it's time to try to make amends. And we see Vito, he arrives at the prison hospital And when he gets to the room, there's two orderlies there and they're making the bed. And he goes, "Where's Jesse McMullen?" He's like, "Oh, it's too late. You don't need to see him." He's like, "What do you mean? Where's Jesse McMullen?" And one of the orderlies goes, "Take the elevator down to the basement and you'll find him there." And Vito's like, "What do you mean the basement?" And then he just runs off. So then we cut to, it's a long master shot and it's of the hallway. And you just see all the way down the corridor. And in the foreground of the corridor, you see a gurney and there's two orderlies pushing it. And there's a body on it with the cover over it. So you assume that might be Jesse and that they start pushing him down the front of the hallway. You're like, "Oh man, Jesse probably passed." And then all the way in the back, you see Vito running around the corner going, "Hey, wait, hey, is that Jesse McMullen? Hey, wait." And the orderlies don't acknowledge, they don't turn around, they just keep going. And they come off front of the screen, and we still see Vito running, 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 running to the front of the screen. And while that's happening, we see the prison doors closing, and it closes right in front of Vito when he gets there. And he realizes that he's not going to be able to say goodbye to his father, not even see his father after he passed to say goodbye to him. And you just see how distraught he is because here was probably a last chance to try to make amends with his dad. And it's just going to end up with him and his dad have not basically spoken since they were on trial, and it's crushing him. And it's all right there on his face. And you see him, he puts his hands up and he's like covers his face. And now he's just kind of angry because he doesn't know what to do. And, you know, he still has the issues with Adam, even though Adam has called, they're still not talking. And even when Vito's mom, Elaine, even mentions Vito to Adam, Adam just, "No, don't mention his name in front of me or I will not even see you anymore." Vito's in a spot where what's next? What's next? And it's all right there in those like 8 seconds of him standing in front of the closed gate. And just, it's a rough one. It's a rough one to not be able to say goodbye to your parents, especially when things are on such a bad terms. So it was a good moment. It's maybe 45 seconds between the two scenes, but it certainly tells you a lot right there. Once again, it's like, why does this not work for the whole movie? This is a good little moment. Put it all together, it just doesn't work.
Couldn't agree more. I was going to say the same exact thing because I'm thinking about the scene as you're doing a great job of letting it unfold. And it is brief, but wow, it does have an impact. That's a moment that has a lot of emotional heft and you feel it. I felt it, felt terrible for Vito. He plays it perfectly. And you see it all in his face and his reaction when he's screaming, running down the hall. This is it. This is his last chance to say goodbye, even though his father may have passed already, but doesn't even get that chance to look at him, at his body. And it's just, it's lost opportunities to either say, "I'm sorry, I love you, goodbye," all of the above. It's gut-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching. And it's really well played out. Was thinking the exact same thing as we've said a couple times now. You're watching it, thinking about it. We're replaying it in our minds as we say it out loud. Great moments, great performances. Why doesn't this work overall? And I'm thinking when you take scenes out of context, they play great. But when you put them all together, there has to be a real through line and motivations have to come through. And it appears that that wasn't there for me when I'm thinking about this now. But that was another example of just a really powerful moment. And I was going to also mention one other moment that really rang true. And this is what I was looking for from the movie. Speaking of motivations, when Vito goes back to Jesse's apartment and catches Jesse before he's supposedly heading out of town, Jesse literally has two suitcases in his hand and is ready to walk out the door. Jesse bursts in and they get into a discussion about Adam. And Jesse says, "Adam is young and wet behind the ears." I'm paraphrasing, but he does say to Vito, he says, "Why do you think Adam set this whole thing up? Because he can smell the real Vito. That's why." And he gets in Dustin Hoffman's face and he balls his fist up and he goes, "This Vito." And he smacks him on the head to call back to what Vito did to Jesse in an earlier scene that I mentioned. And he goes, "This Vito. That's the real Vito. That's the one he wants respect from." And I'm like, that's what I'm looking from this movie. That's it. That's the crux of it for why Adam's doing what he's doing, because he knows who his real dad is, and he wants that real dad to respect him. So that was just another great moment. I'm like, dang it. Do I have to rethink this movie? I'm watching these scenes and moments out of context. I'm like, wait, do I really like this movie? It's confusing.
Yeah, a lot of good pieces overall. So saying that, let's move on to Swiss Cheese and Complaints Department. And why do we call it Swiss Cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have caper holes.
Yes, and if it doesn't have any of those caper holes, we just file a complaint with the Complaint Department. Jason, what do you have for possible holes or complaints?
All right. Overall, I had mentioned just the flatness. It has moments. It has scenes, but the through line's not quite there for me, or the impact of the through line's not there for me. I wanted to hear from these characters why this life of criminality is so attractive and alluring and fun and sexy, and why they justify that life. Going back to the opening quote, once again, when Jesse says to Vito, where did you get it in your head? It was so terrible to be a thief. And I want to know, where did you get it in your head, Jesse, that it was okay to be a thief? What is it about this lifestyle? Sell it to me. Maybe that's a problem I'm having with the movies. I'm not totally sold on why, because even the caper itself isn't that sexy. The movie doesn't sell the idea, the romanticism of being a thief for me. That's just a complaint I had.
Yeah, I think for me, my biggest complaint is actually kind of the caper itself, because
sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we find out that Adam gets this information from his professor. Now, what we do find out is that the plasmids were false. The reason they need to do this caper is they need to buy more time, because they've told their investors that they're going to have this breakthrough at any moment, and they're not anywhere close. Everything they thought that was going to happen did not. And they really need to rethink this project, and they need time. So that's why they set up this caper. It's basically to buy them more time. So somehow Adam's professor tells Adam about this. It's like, how does he know to pinpoint Adam? It's not like I could tell all my students, like, hey, I need someone to break into my lab,
right,
and steal some plasmids for me. You know, it's like, how does that come up? It's like, he's a model student. And even if you think, or find out you have, your parents have a, family has a criminal background. Because if it gets out there, someone else could say, oh yeah, he did this because it's a scam. Is this making any sense?
I think so. You're asking why the professor from this biology lab where Adam worked, and by the way, the professor's character's name is Jimmy Chu, and we haven't mentioned that yet, but Chu, this professor, why did he recruit Adam? Why did Correct. He recruit Matthew Broderick's character?
Because you have to recruit the right person
to pull off this job. Now, if he was privy to this information that Adam was part of a crime family and that would have the know-how, but still, we don't see that. And by all appearances, Adam does not look like a seasoned criminal professional.
Not at all.
I agree. That's a great point. There are certain elements from a caper movie that are missing here. And I want to make a correction here. We do see a scene where the three of these gentlemen, these three generations, are going shopping for the tools, which is fun. And we see Vito grab like a giant sledgehammer and put it in the cart along with other tools. And then later on, we do see Adam laying out various tools on a bed and throwing them into a bag for this job. But we don't see them implement any of those tools.
Zero.
They don't use any of the tools on the caper. So we do see some tools, but there are aspects such as the recruitment of Adam. How does he get chosen by Professor Chu to do this job? That's a great point. I didn't even think about that.
But even the caper itself,
mm-hmm.
It starts off, they get to the building, and one of the things that they have to their disposal is a key pass. So they don't have to break into any doors. They just swipe the key and punch in the code. And Adam swipes the key and he's about to punch in the code. And Vito goes, where's your gloves? And Adam's like, I don't have.
That's my next complaint.
Wait a second. You're preparing for this robbery caper, whatever we want to call it. Did you not go over the ABCs of committing a crime with your son? Like, he has no clue what to do throughout this whole crime. If you know if someone's going to be that inexperienced, you would think you would be overstating everything that you need to do in order to make sure you don't get caught.
Right.
The first thing would be gloves. We can't leave fingerprints.
That's a huge part. Yeah.
Oh my God. He's like learning while it's going on. I'm like, I get it. He's green, but there's all things everyone should kind of know. Try not to leave any evidence.
It's frustrating because you're going, wait, if we're to believe that Jesse and Vito themselves were professionals and we know that Adam is green, the first thing they would do is prepare him and train him for this job. It right. would be part of a planning sequence. And that's where this movie also misses the mark, because is this a family drama? Is it a caper movie? If it's going to have a caper, we have to have some planning stages, and that's half the fun. And of course, I go to one of my favorites, which is Ocean's 11. You want to see the blueprints. You want to see them rehearsing the crime or the caper. You want to see them. There's always a sequence in these heist movies where they go over the stages. You know, it's like, okay, stage one, where do you need to be? Oh, I need to be at this place at this time. Good. Stage two, use the key card to get through the door. Stage three, lay out the tools, whatever it might be, or apprehend the guard, take out the guard. And you see those scenes, or they lay it out and you're like, oh, these guys are smart. They're clever. They're prepared. They thought about it. They thought it through. And it seems like these are just bumbling morons that didn't think about anything. What are you doing, guys?
No. And then even moving forward with the caper. So they're there to get plasmids and a logbook.
Right.
They get there and Adam's kind of turned around of where he's supposed to be. They finally get in the lab. Peter's getting a little nervous because they've been in there too long. And then Adam finds the logbook, notice that there's something wrong, but we don't know what it is. And then they get the plasmids and then they start running out. They know from the get-go, plasmids and logbook. Are you telling me two experienced burglars don't remember, hey, where's the logbook?
Right.
They wait until they get outside. And when they get outside, Adam goes, who's got the logbook? And of course, Vito and Jess are like, we don't have the logbook. And Adam goes, I'll go back in and get it. And Jesse wanted to get it, or Vito wanted to get it. And they're like, no, I'll go get it. So he runs back in, gets the logbook. While he's running back out, because he's moving too fast, he sets off one of the alarms. While he sets up the alarm, Vito and Jesse are in the getaway car. And before even Adam gets out of the building, the police are already showing up.
Right.
Please, unless that police station is right around the corner, there is no way in hell. Unless he had to walk from the top of the building all the way down to the bottom, still he would have enough time.
There were a couple, you know, there's a couple cops and they're black and whites parked at a 7-Eleven getting donuts right around the corner. It was very convenient.
Even then they wouldn't be there on time. So they get there and instead of Adam running to the car, he stops and gives himself up. And I'm like, dude, you can run. There's no way the cops can follow you because there is a barricade to the freeway that the cops cannot get around in time. Yes, they might be able to spot the car and get a license plate. They can be long gone by then. Why he gives himself up at that moment makes no sense to me also.
I was livid. I was screaming at the screen. It is poorly staged. It's yes. poorly shot. Because it makes no sense at all. I'm going to take it one step back.
Go
back to what is supposed to be, I believe, some comedy inserted into this caper. Because we're to assume that Adam received a maybe index card size map of the laboratory and searches every single room because the map is either written out poorly or whatever. They can't find the room that has the plasmids. And I was just like, who planned this?
Yeah.
Your map it doesn't make any sense. They would have known exactly which room the plasmids were located in and the logbooks. And then, like you said, they run out with the plasmids, but they left the logbook behind. Why is Adam asking them where the logbook? He was the one that went through the logbooks in the room with the files and everything. He's the one looking at the logbooks. Why is he asking them if they have the logbooks? It was his responsibility in that moment. So that didn't make any sense, but you nailed it. He has a million years to evade the cops.
Yes.
To run over the median where there's like a lawn and there's bushes and to get into the car with Jesse and Vito. And instead, as soon as he sees the red and blue cop lights glow, he decides to freeze, throw the logbook into the lawn, the area, wherever it was in that median between the lab and the actual street. And gives himself up as if he's being a martyr in this situation. And it is ridiculous because literally as it is shot in the movie and as it is paced and sequenced, it takes like 2 minutes for the cops to even show up and get out of their cars and arrest him mm-hmm. or tell him to put his hands up. He had all the time in the world to get out of there.
Right.
It makes no sense the way it's played out.
Right. And then the cops at that point ask him where his partners are. And I get it. He says they're inside to try to buy more time. But why do you say there's two more other people? Could have just said one or I'm by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. He could have said anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he that you're right. That's a good call too. Yeah, to actually say two other people, it's too specific. Not great. Not
Yeah, that
great.
was definitely a weak moment. Even though I remembered it out of everything, it is a weak moment.
Well, I didn't really have a lot else.
I'm just gonna do one last little complaint. We can
Absolutely.
move on.
No, Duke, go for it.
So in the Passover scene, we find out that Adam has a girlfriend and she is mentioned in it. And I was like, oh, who's the girlfriend gonna be? And then it ends up being Victoria Jackson. I'm like, oh, and she has one scene
Rough.
that doesn't work at all. It's like, what? Sorry.
Well, isn't that interesting? We keep calling out, there's so many scenes that are great, and you take them out of context, they really work. There are definitely a few scenes, as we've also mentioned, like there's a scene at Doheny's, or that scene at the dinner table with Victoria Jackson feels very out of place. Why did we need that information? Why did we need to see that? Yes, she herself is doing some underhanded business in her line of work. We find that out. Great. Victoria Jackson feels completely miscast in this part. It just
Yes.
seems really weird. She's really sticks out like a sore thumb. And then Jesse, Sean Connery's character, is really mean to her in the sequence. They're like, I don't know why we need to see this.
That should have been in the cutting room floor. Sorry.
Yeah. There are a few scenes where
I'm
you're just like,
sure
is this filler
Victoria
or what?
Jackson is a lovely person.
Oh, she's great. SNL alum. She's wonderful. She's funny. She's great, but doesn't belong
She
in this.
plays the type of characters I don't like. Dits, dits, and that's all I associate with her is dits. And even her time on SNL, I mean, did she really do anything memorable? She was the weak link. She was the weak. All I remember is that one time where she was dancing on the table during Weekend Update. Outside of that, I don't think she brought anything. Especially when you had like Nora Dunn and Jan Hooks. She was a distant third in my book.
Yeah, she's got that voice.
Sorry, Victoria.
All right, shots at Victoria Jackson on
I
this
know. I shouldn't
podcast.
have done that. I apologize. But that scene
Hey.
just doesn't work. That scene doesn't work, and she's miscast.
It's all right.
I'll leave it at that.
People wouldn't listen to us if we didn't have opinions. We got to have
Yeah.
opinions on this. All right.
All right, it's about time for Hey, it's that actor.
Dun, 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 dun. I feel like there should be a music cue here. Hey, all right.
Yeah, maybe we should get one. In this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut. Or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's Hey, it's that actor. Who do we choose this week?
This week, Bill Bandt, it's my game show host
Yeah, keep it
voice.
going.
Our Hey, It's That Actor is B.D. Wong. B.D. Wong as ex-professor Dr. Jimmy Chu. Now, we love, or at least I'll say I love B.D. Wong. He's an actor who's had so many different supporting roles in about a million different TV shows and movies. Let's just skim over his 80s real quick. He was Boy on Street in The Karate Kid Part 2. How about that? Very, very tiny role. And he did a handful of
Great
TV.
job. Great job there.
And he did a handful of TV series and TV movies in the 80s. And of course, this in 89, Family Business. He was in The Freshman in 1990. He is very well known for his role as Howard Weinstein, or is it Weinstein? Howard Weinstein in the Father of the Bride movies. And he then starts his run as Dr. Henry Wu, scientist in the Jurassic Park films. He was in the first Jurassic Park and then reprises his roles in the Jurassic World films. I actually loved him in Executive Decision in 1996. He is the voice of Captain Li Shang in the Disney Mulan films. He did 22 episodes as the character White Rose in Mr. Robot, that acclaimed TV show. He was recently the character King of Clubs in the Gal Gadot vehicle on Netflix, Heart of Stone. Last but certainly not least, he has been Special Agent Dr. George Huang, MD, on 230 episodes of Law and Order SVU from 2001 to 2015. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was he on the other Law and Orders too? Would he pop in and out of those? Was it only SVU?
I know I've seen him on SVU because, there's
Yeah.
those three cable channels. That's all they show. But I wouldn't be surprised if he popped up on one of the other ones.
Right. I'm assuming he did. I may have missed it in his filmography. But anyway, we do know him very well from Law and Order SVU. I'm going to mention this. Back in the 80s, he won Broadway's 1988 Tony Award as Best Actor for creating featured role, I should say, in a play for creating the role of Song Li Ling in M. Butterfly. He is the only actor to be honored with the Tony Award, Drama Desk Award, Outer Critics Circle Award, Clarence Derwent Award, and Theater World Award for the same performance. Now, B.D. Wong chose to go by his initials while playing his breakthrough role in M. Butterfly. The title character's gender is ambiguous, and he decided that using his initials instead of his full name would make it difficult to guess whether he was a man or a woman, thus adding to the androgyny of the character he was playing. So, if you're wondering what the BD stands for in B.D. Wong, it's Bradley Darrell. He's a staple. He's great. He's now 63 years old, still doing it. He is our Hey, It's That Actor this week.
I'll be honest, when I saw him in that scene, I literally go, hey, is that B.D. Wong? So yeah, I almost said, hey, it's that actor. Yep.
Right.
All right. So moving on to facts and trivia. Well, yeah, we were scraping the bottom of the barrel this one. We apologize, audience. There wasn't very much on this movie.
Yeah.
But what do we have for facts and trivia about Family Business?
Well, let's see here. We will just shout out the ages and of our actors and the character ages. Jesse McMullen was 60 years old in the movie. Sean Connery playing Jesse was 58 during filming. Vito McMullen, played by Dustin Hoffman, is 43 years old in the movie, but Dustin Hoffman was 51. And Adam McMullen, played by Matthew Broderick, the character was 23 or about to be 23, and Broderick was 26. So although Sean Connery plays Dustin Hoffman's father, he's actually in real life only 7 years older than Dustin Hoffman.
Yep. And that's what everybody had to point their finger at when they came to this movie.
Right.
Really hard to find stuff for this. So I'm going to talk about our screenwriter, Vincent Patrick, who is an American author and screenwriter. He wrote the books The Pope of Greenwich Village and Family Business and adapted both books for the screen. Patrick had an interesting life before becoming a writer. After dropping out of high school, he began selling Bibles door to door. Patrick found the job dishonest, so he returned to his studies, earning a high school diploma, and graduated from New York University with a degree in mechanical engineering. Patrick abandoned the profession in his mid-30s to take up writing. He also co-wrote The Devil's Own and wrote uncredited early treatments for films including Beverly Hills Cop and The Godfather Part III.
He co-wrote The Devil's Own.
Yep.
The Harrison Ford Brad Pitt movie.
Yes.
Huh. All right. All right. Thank you for telling us a little bit about Vincent Patrick. Let's get into this. 3 weeks of rehearsal in a large hall on New York City's Lower East Side preceded the start of principal photography on November 14, 1988. It had been Sidney Lumet's practice since his work in the early days of live television to factor a lengthy rehearsal period into the production schedule of all of his movies. Dustin Hoffman commented, "In a sense, you've killed the first 3 weeks with most movies because it usually takes that long before people start letting others into their lives. At the start of any film, there is a kind of barrier separating the actors. The way Sidney works, with a lengthy rehearsal time prior to the production, you're at a place when you start shooting that you wouldn't be in most other pictures until you are halfway through them."
So the lab in which the robbery took place is known as the Jericho Plaza, which is in Jericho, New York. Jericho's Plaza trapezoid-shaped buildings were designed by the Woodbury-based Spectre Group and was developed on the site of a former sod farm back in 1980. Its 695,000-square-foot complex sits on 51 acres of land. And surprisingly, I could not find that it was ever used in another movie. Those buildings are so unique-looking, I thought for sure it'd be used somewhere else, but as of
no doubt.
I could find my research, only Family Business. I thought they were cool looking buildings.
I agree. I agree with that. Absolutely. This was the final collaboration of Sir Sean Connery and director Sidney Lumet. Their others being The Hill in 1965, The Anderson Tapes in 71, The Offense in 73, and Murder on the Orient Express in 74. In the opening shot of this movie, there is a sign on the side of a building that says Network. Sidney Lumet, of course, directed Network in 1976.
All right, let's move on to box office. So Family Business, as you mentioned before, was released on December 15th, 1989 in 1,201 theaters. I could not find the exact budget of the movie, but it only grossed $11.1 million domestically. It debuted number six at the box office behind The Wizard, starring Fred Savage, by a mere $12,000, and stayed in the top 10 for just another week. Family Business was the 80th highest grossing movie of 1989 between Gross Anatomy and Who's Harry Crumb. Moving on to reviews, when growing up in the 80s, we would watch At the Movies with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear their reviews and watch clips of upcoming movies. Their review of Family Business was split. Gene didn't like the tone of the film and thought it was all over the place, and the caper itself wasn't very exciting. While Roger did agree with Gene, he really enjoyed Sean Connery's performance and thought his scenes with Dustin Hoffman worked also. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 35% with an audience score even less, 28%, and it also has an IMDb rating of 5.7. So that takes us to additional thoughts and questions. What are some additional thoughts and questions we have about Family Business?
I was just going to ask in general, how long did you think it had been since Adam saw his grandfather, Jesse? Because we see them reunite after Adam bails him out of jail. And it just seems sort of weird as to, we're talking about Adam's motivation for doing the caper in the first place, but to approach his grandfather to do this job after he hasn't seen him in a long time, and to have such a strong fondness for him, an affinity for Jesse. He hasn't seen him in years. And they spend one night hanging out and then it's like, hey, do you want to commit a crime together, Grandpa? I don't know. Did that feel weird at all?
First, I thought it seemed like after he dropped out that maybe he had seen Jesse once or twice, because that was the impression I was given.
Mm.
And then I was like, no, I think this is the first time he's seeing him since he's gotten out of school also. So I think he hasn't seen Jesse since maybe high school.
Right.
So you're thinking if he's getting his master's 7-8 years ago, so that's a long freaking time. So I don't know if they keep in any kind of contact. There must be some kind of contact because Jesse knew that Adam was going to be at the Passover celebration.
The Seder. Yeah.
Yeah. The Seder.
I just thought that was interesting because I don't know if it would have been a stronger choice to have established just more of a relationship between Adam and Jesse prior to this, as if Adam would regularly go visit Jesse in jail from time if Jesse were to get busted. But it clearly, this was one incident where Jesse got into a bar fight with an off-duty cop. That's why he landed in jail for the night and he needed to get bailed out. So it's not as if Jesse's been away in the clink for 20 years.
Correct.
He's been living apart above Doheny's, yet Adam hasn't seen him in, like we're saying, maybe since high school or earlier.
Yeah.
I'm trying to put that together.
Has he been sending him stolen birthday gifts or Christmas presents or Hanukkah presents? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If it would have been established that they had a prior relationship or a stronger relationship, it would make sense that Adam felt like, I am of age now. I've come of age and I'm ready to go on a caper with you, Grandpa. Let's do this.
Right. Yeah.
What do you got, man?
Adam's the weak point. So Jesse's girl, and I'll give you time to think of the Rick Springfield song while I mentioned that, because that just pops in my head every time we say Jesse's girl. So that was played by Janet Carroll. And every time I saw her on screen, it was driving me nuts because I'm like, where do I know this woman from?
Sure. Yeah.
And it took until the third watching of this movie that I realized that was Tom Cruise's mom in Risky Business.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it was driving me nuts.
Of course.
I thought maybe we were going to make her, hey, it's that actor.
Yep.
But then I did think maybe B.D. Wong, so that's why I didn't mention his name earlier, because I was like, oh, I don't want to give it away. But yeah, that was driving crazy. I was like, why do I know this woman? Why does she look so familiar? And then I was like, oh my God, it's Tom Cruise's mom from Risky.
This movie actually does have a handful of Hey, It's That actors, for sure.
Yes, it does.
We gave a shout out to most of them, Bill McCutcheon, Victoria Jackson, B.D. Wong, Luis Guzman. Mm-hmm. And we can't leave out James Tolkien, the judge.
Yes.
I mean, he's our guy from our bald-headed best friend from Top Gun and Back to the Future, the principal. I mean,
you wanted him to call them all slackers. Before I sentence you, slackers.
One of the most recognizable, hey, it's that actor. This movie's got him.
All right, so here's a question. It came out of, one of my favorite moments is when Vito beats the crap out of Torres. Because the secretary kind of said something. Was she having an affair with Vito? Did you get that impression? Or possibly? I thought there was something that she kind of said. I was like, wait, are they kind of sleeping together on the side there?
His secretary at the meat packing plant, at the meat processor. Yes, I totally agree. It's so, I'm glad you brought that up, only because I had just rewatched that scene before we got on to record. And I thought the same thing. She brings up the fact that there's been some other intimate activity on the side, and he has a very specific line, and I only caught it on the second time I saw it. He said, what did he say? He says something to the effect of, relates to being married, and you can't, oh, he says, don't crap where you eat.
Right. So that's what got me.
And that's referring confused. To he's sleeping around. He's
right.
He was sleeping around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's such a throwaway.
And I was like, oh.
And I didn't ever go back to her. So I was kind of, what? Hey, huh? What? So you caught on that too. Go ahead. I'm glad. Well, I guess when you watch these movies enough times for these podcasts.
Right.
We get there. All right. So here's my big question, Jason. So we're going to go a little bit in the time machine here. So we're back in college. And Marwan, who was a guest on our Die Hard episode, he ran a family business. Now, our friends that mostly that we hung out with weren't as versed in movies as we were. I mean, some of them were. So I don't want to throw everybody in the bus. So they're asking who's in that movie and who are Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, and Matthew Broderick? So we decide to do a movie marathon to show our friends a movie that showcases the actors. It doesn't have to be their best movie, but one that would get our friends excited about watching Family Business with us. So what would you pick? So one movie from each of our three main actors. What would be our marathon going into Family Business?
That is a fantastic question. I love the scenario only because it takes me back to those college days when we would hang out in dorm rooms and have these movie marathons. I wish we could still do that today. We were able to make time for that today. That'd be nice. But I would say that Sean Connery, I would obviously take a James Bond film. I would go with, let's go near the beginning, or back to the beginning with From Russia with Love. That's one of my favorites.
Oh, okay, good one.
I would choose that one. Sean Connery is a stud, hairpiece or not. He was a great Bond. And he was, for a lot of us, maybe the best Bond still to this day. That's up for debate. However, I would go with From Russia with Love for him. Ferris Bueller's no question for Broderick. That's just my go-to. It's the first thing I think of when I see his face. And Dustin Hoffman is interesting. I would probably say Rain Man. It's an Academy Award winning performance. It's drawn some criticism in the years since for his portrayal of someone with severe autism. That's, again, up for debate. I still appreciate his performance in that. But I'm tempted to say Kramer versus Kramer, even though I haven't seen that in forever, and I'm not sure if I've seen it from beginning to end. So that to recommend that film to somebody and not really being that familiar with it myself, I'd probably just then go with Rain Man. But yeah, I guess that's it, right?
Yeah.
How about you, Bill Bant?
Okay, my programming would be a little bit different. So yes, with Sean Connery, I'm picking a Bond movie. I'm going with Goldfinger. From Rush with Love. I'd even kind of consider that one for some reason, but that is a really good one. A lot of people do like that. For Matthew Broderick, I was going back and forth between Ferris Bueller and War Games, but I went with War Games.
No Project X?
That was a distant sixth.
Yeah. Okay.
And then Dustin Hoffman for me was actually the hardest one to come up with, because I think originally I was going to go with Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, yeah. Great call. That's a great call. I should have thought of that.
I didn't want to play like an eccentric character, because I'm like, that's not what he does in Family Business. So I was trying to find something that was a little more normal. So I was like, oh, I can't do Rain Man or Papillion. I can't say that one right either. I just went with The Graduate.
The Graduate. Heck yeah. Young Dustin Hoffman. You know what I also need to see is Marathon Man. I've still not seen that.
Is it safe? Yeah, that's a good one. I've only seen it once. I need to see that again, too. Yeah, God, he's done a lot. Unfortunately, most of them don't fall into the 80s, but he's got a great filmography.
Oh, yeah. Dustin Hoffman's one of the greats, obviously. Two-time Academy Award winner.
Yeah. Another easy question. Sidney Lumet has made some amazing movies, and two of them we will certainly cover for our podcast, The Verdict and Death Trap. But do you have a favorite Sidney Lumet movie or two?
You know, that's the tough question, because when you go over his filmography, you're like, these are to have at least, you could say, 7 or 8 bona fide all-time greats that are must-sees, and then right. you could add in a few others. Your mileage may vary on a few of the other films, but there are the obvious ones. But I think I have to go with Dog Day Afternoon. I think that's going to be my choice.
I had that. It's my second, yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably the one of his I've probably seen the most, and that's with the Al Pacino. But yeah, 12 Angry Men.
Yeah.
If you have not watched that one, got to see that one.
Yes.
Henry Fonda and just so many other set actors in that one. That's for sure.
No doubt. Sidney Lumet, man. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. As far as other additional thoughts and questions, you know, at the beginning, we see that Jesse is released from jail in a $500 cash bond that Adam pays. And I was wondering, whatever happened to that pending case then?
Oh, yeah. That goes nowhere.
Right. And I assume, well, he ended up going to jail anyway for the caper. So maybe that disappears then, or what happens with that case? I don't think it just disappears. Regardless. So when I mentioned the scene briefly in one of my favorite moments, when Vito barges into Jesse's apartment as Jesse's about to leave, he's got his suitcases packed. Where's Jesse going? Is he really just going to desert? Is he just getting out of town? And on top of that, what did Jesse have in his suitcases, or at least one of them? Because we see Vito grab the suitcase, throw it on the bed, open it, and there's a bunch of square plastic wrapped bags that fall out. What were in the bags? Did you understand
that? I couldn't figure that out either. It's like, did he use the money that he got to buy that and then was going to sell it for even more of a profit? I don't know. I don't know what it was.
I think there's something missing. Maybe it was a deleted scene or something, because that was very confusing to me. That's obviously not how you pack clothes traditionally. Right. So I was like, oh, did he pack his clothes in vacuum sealed bags? Or was that supposed to be money in those bags? It wasn't clear.
No, not at all. All right, let's move on to our rating. So on a scale of 1 to 5 plasmids, what do you give Family Business?
This is interesting. I have to say I was wavering, but I did end up on 3 plasmids. This movie's okay. I don't have any really strong feelings about it. The acting is very good. The story's flat. The movie ends and I was unaffected. I didn't mention this earlier. I didn't care for the musical score at all. Sorry, Cy Coleman, but the music feels dated. Feels like it's from a 70s comedy. It's a little big band style, and it just doesn't work for this for me. That's my opinion. Dustin Hoffman, Connery, really strong acting moments. Otherwise, just the through line just sort of happens in a flat line with a crescendo here and there. It's as if you're watching the heart monitor hooked up to somebody in a hospital, and you hear the, and it's flat line, but then you see the heartbeat go off a couple of times. That's how I describe this movie. And then it just returns to a flat line at the end. But I'm just going to be generous and give it a 3 for the performances and for, if you can just watch the scenes out of context, they're actually impactful. Just doesn't work as a whole, as Bill Band has mentioned. So that's it for me. 3 plasmids.
Yeah, I'm going 2.5. And most of the same reasons that you said, you didn't know anything about this movie. And I said, look up these scenes on YouTube. And you're like, oh man, this looks really good. And then you would watch it and go, what the hell happened? And I think really it is. It's just story-wise. It's just the Adam character just doesn't work. And it kind of drags the whole movie down. And then Caper itself is kind of meh at best. But you have 3 studs there with the acting. I think they all do a good job. I mean, Matthew Broderick's just stuck with, he just has a bad character, unfortunately, but he does a good job. Yeah, you are really watching for Sean Connery and Dustin Hoffman. You get through it, but it's just not great. I was surprised that it bombed as bad as it did, because I would just think, just based on their names alone, it would have got at least double what it made.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But yeah, man, that was terrible. Not even 15 million.
Yeah. Too many other big blockbusters that year.
Yeah. All right. So I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please take the time to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Give us a review and rate us. If you want to learn more about our show, you can visit us at all80smoviespodcast.com. For our next episode, we'll be discussing Roxanne, starring Steve Martin and Daryl Hannah. Hope you can join us. Have an excellent week, everyone.
Hey, you bald-headed prick. Don't you ever get caught on the take, because if you wind up in any joint I'm in, you'll leave feet first. Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.